please join me in welcoming Madeleine.
Thank you so much to Marlene for the introduction and for the invitation to present here. It's a real honour to be here, especially among so many people that I consider really mentors and colleagues, even some former students, and it's a real honour to be able to present at CESS. So thank you so much to Marlene for the invitation. I'm going to read a paper in the hope that this allows me to stick to time a little better. Last summer, while conducting some library research in Moscow, I was woken early one morning in the dormitory apartment of the Kyrgyz acquaintance, Albina, whom I had been visiting. Albina, glued to her phone, was discussing an Amerikanka, an American, with her husband. Albina had been living in Moscow for most of the previous 9 years, where she worked 3 jobs and a 60-hour working week as a gynecologist in private medical clinics. Her husband, meanwhile, was in Bishkek, the capital of Kyrgyzstan, where he was overseeing the decoration of a new apartment in one of the city's recently constructed so-called elite high-rise buildings. This is one of them, paid for with the couple's earnings in Russia. I wondered who the Amerikanka they were discussing might be. Perhaps another researcher. Perhaps someone whom Albina had found to help teach her English. But this Amerikanka, according to Albina's comments at least, had too much gold and was too lumpy. She was an inanimate thing. As I pulled myself out of bed and peered over to where Albina was glued to her smartphone, I realized that Albina and Khairat weren't discussing a new American acquaintance, but a brand of wallpaper, one of several possibilities for decorating their new apartment. Using Viber, one of several mobile phone apps that has become an integral part of the infrastructure of transnationalism between Kyrgyzstan and Russia, Khairat and Albina were discussing one part of their home decoration. Khairat in Bishkek was at the market, where he photographed and uploaded images of the different wallpapers that he was considering. And to those in the room under the age of 40, Viber is a mobile phone app that allows you to upload pictures and text messages and various other things. This was introduced to me by Albina. I was unaware of this. Albina, in turn, would comment by text message, adding in short, telegraphic spoken comments where necessary. The whole of their new Bishkek apartment, down to plumbing fixtures, floor tiles, paint, kitchen appliances, and so forth, had been discussed this way with photos, instant messaging, and free phone calls. This morning conversation continued in this way for about 40 minutes while Albina was doing other things, while the details of wallpaper and light fittings were determined. Since Khairat had moved to Bishkek several months earlier, Viber had served as a constant rolling backdrop to their respective days. Albina reflected on how the nature of her own connection with home had shifted during the near decade that she had been working in Russia. In the early days, there had been no phone connection with her or Khairat's parents. Staying in touch consisted in a fortnightly conversation with a relative in Osh, who in turn passed messages to their families in Batken district. Now, if Khairat didn't hear from Albina for a few hours, he began to get nervous. Her distance from him didn't make him any less curious as to her whereabouts, or, as she pointed out, any less rivnivy or jealous. Indeed, one of the reasons they used Viber, she confided, was that it had a GPS function. Each could tell exactly where the other was physically located. For 2 decades now, scholars of transnationalism have been reflecting on the density of connections that sustain translocal intimacies in contexts of protracted outmigration. Khairat and Albina's experiences are unexceptional in this regard, their everyday lives involving the habitual and unreflexive movement between languages, here Russian and Kyrgyz, currencies, time zones, administrative regulations, passports — they both held Russian citizenship but also used Kyrgyz passports — and gendered modes of behavior. But if transnationalism implies an affective connection to two places simultaneously, for Khairat and Albina, Batken in southern Kyrgyzstan remained home, morally and imaginatively. Indeed, Kairat had commented in one of his extensive conversations with me when I had first met him 4 years earlier, "All the same, even with a Russian passport here, we're chorny, we're black." Moscow, for Kairat at least, never felt entirely like home. And he had other ambitions for the future than staying in town. In the summer of 2015, Kairat's picture was on billboards around Batken town. I haven't included his picture here for confidentiality reasons. As he was running on the party list for one of Kyrgyzstan's smaller political parties. In fact, I ran into him, as you do, in Batken airport, and he said, "Oh, I'm running for parliament." Albina, in a headscarf now and a long skirt, figured on this campaign material alongside Kairat, her demeanour revealing little of the decade of Moscow life that had enabled her husband's electoral campaign to materialise. There are a couple of seats here. I hate seeing people standing at the back. If people need seats, there are some on the front row. I begin with this vignette to open a little the question that I want to explore in this keynote concerning the ways that we might reimagine area studies in an age of mass migration and mediated transnationalism. Migration has not unmoored Kairat and Albina from place. Indeed, it's striking the degree to which their earnings have been invested in articulating connections to multiple Kyrgyz places, to the village of Kairat's parents, to Batken town, where they eventually wanted their daughter to attend school, to Bishkek, where the rental income from a newly refurbished apartment would act as a safety net if the ruble crisis continued. But their hopes, their imaginations, their economic strategies, their livelihoods, even their modes of communicating intimacy cannot be separated from the fact that their lives are lived simultaneously in two social fields, 3,000 kilometres apart. A world in which Albina presents herself to her Moscow clientele as Svetlana Kim, as a Russian of Korean heritage, where the minutiae of how to do up their Kyrgyz room, their Kyrgyz uy, in an apartment that is marketed as European can be decided before breakfast, where a husband can check whether his wife has come home on time using the GPS function on her mobile phone. What has area studies to say about this, or about the millions of lives and livelihoods that would challenge our methodological regionalism? The challenge, I think, for area studies is not just that lives such as these are lived across the boundaries of conventional regional demarcations of the world, though that for sure is still an issue. Scott Levi has eloquently described how he was discouraged from studying Indian traders in Central Asia because the project just didn't fit conventional area studies frameworks. Area studies, after all, has paid plenty of attention to migration from the perspective of sending or receiving communities, a binary nonetheless that still posits singular place as the site of origin or destination. My concern more fundamentally is to do with how area studies has tended to conceive of space itself, and the implications of this for scholarship and for the kinds of questions that we ask. My claim is that area studies has tended to operate with a rather flat and atheoretical account of space, as flat, inert, isomorphic, bounded, as a two-dimensional platform upon which social life is conducted, and that this has implications for the kind of questions that we have asked and for our theoretical ambition, as well as for our ability to speak to scholars outside of our area studies field. I want to ask here what might follow if we adopt an approach to space that treats it, as geographer Doreen Massey has put it, as lively. That is to say, not as a static plane upon which action takes place, but as itself, as she puts it, that sphere of a dynamic simultaneity, constantly disconnected by new arrivals, constantly awaiting to be determined by the construction of new relations. Can we, in other words, imagine area studies without being tied to the category of area in the sense of a two-dimensional Euclidean version of space as surface? And can we do so, for this is the bit that really interests me, while nonetheless retaining a defense of area studies as such, that is to say, while defending the value of a scholarship attentive to context, to history, to language, to complex institutional legacies, to alternative registers of value, and to the specificity of place? I'll put my cards on the table and suggest that we can. Moreover, that such a project is critically important in the face of two strands of social science mainstream. One in its more predictive and quantifying variant that would reduce culture or ethnicity or religious identity to independent variables in a formal model. And the other in those self-proclaimed critical variants, varieties of post-structuralism and globalization theory, that in assuming that the whole planet has fallen under totalizing discursive practices originating from the West, fails to recognize their own Eurocentrism. In other words, area studies, I think, has something to say to versions of social science mainstream that often think of themselves as opposed, both of which nonetheless erase context and specificity. In the second half of my talk, I want to explore some ways that we might reimagine area studies that takes area itself as a critical object of attention and not merely as a framing device. Analogously, say, to how queer theory has playfully reworked the very category of queer, to suggest some alternative spatial and temporal idioms that might engage in, that we might engage in such a process of imagination. But before that, I want to try and tackle head-on the question of area studies' relevance, for it will come as news to few in this audience that the fate of area studies, and Central Eurasian studies in particular, tends to follow the winds of geopolitics. And these winds are not blowing kindly right now, and Laura Adams has done a lot of work to kind of illuminate this. It was not always thus. 12 years ago, in a series of invited articles on the fate of Caucasus and Central Asian studies for the Social Science Research Council, a number of eminent scholars, some of them in this room, wrote with cautious hope that the tide of Central Asia's marginalization might be turning. Stephen Hansen noted in his contribution that, quote, the shock of the events of 9/11 has obviously refocused government and academic attention back to the Caucasus and Central Asia, making their hard-won specialist knowledge of these regions relevant again to the social science mainstream. I remember CES conferences in the early 2000s when prospective scholars of Afghanistan were courted by government folk in sleek suits with abundant supplies of business cards. Maybe they're still here, I don't know. Central Asianists, it seemed, were in demand, though less by a social science mainstream, perhaps, than by government and military agencies engaged in a war on terror. A decade on, though, that moment of optimism about our potential to shape a social science mainstream perhaps looks more like a temporary blip. The subsequent decade, a poignant reminder of the way that opportunities for meaningful international scholarly dialogue can be sacrificed on the altar of securitization. In 2013, the US government's Title VIII research and training funding, which supported a whole raft of language and area studies programs, failed to receive any allocation from the State Department. When the program was reinstated earlier this year, its budget, $1.5 million, was less than half that of 2012. It's not difficult in such a context to find bleak prognoses for the field. Kenneth Yalowitz and Matthew Rzhansky wrote in the National Interest last year of the slow death of Russian and Eurasian studies. Sarah Kendzior pitched her keynote to students of the Central Eurasian Studies program in Indiana last year as a eulogy to Central Asian studies. And Stephen Hansen, whom I quoted a moment ago, argued in his 2014 presidential address to ASES, the Association for Slavic, East European and Eurasian Studies, that area studies is dead, and we should instead find a new moniker to describe what it is we do and how we work. Hansen's suggestion, which I'll return to later, is for us to redefine area studies as global and regional studies. Certainly, then, there are plenty of reasons to be concerned about the prospects for our field, of which the fortunes of US State Department allocations are only one, not insignificant, aspect. Central Eurasia remains on the margins of better established and better resourced area studies programs. Acquiring the languages needed for research can demand time, tenacity, improvisation, and a lot of luck as universities cut back on their language provision. At the same time, as many of us know, the number of jobs in which the search is specifically for a scholar of Central Eurasia in, say, political science, anthropology, history, sociology, can pretty much be counted on the fingers of one hand. I know of one sociologist conducting doctoral research in an Ivy League university who was told outright that Kyrgyzstan doesn't sell, and that if she was looking for a job at the end of her doctorate, she would better undertake a comparative study with China. It's often said in response that we shouldn't care, or that marginalization is no bad thing. Intellectual creativity emerges from the edges, we are told, those places where the grand theories, conventional periodizations, and established orthodoxies don't fit. Well, yes, and there have been some brilliant examples of that when it comes to, say, histories of 20th century collectivization, or the so-called era of stagnation under Brezhnev, which in large parts of Central Asia was anything but. And again, I think of scholars in this room who've contributed to these literatures. But such heterodoxy only works if there is an audience. If a tree falls in the forest of Central Eurasian studies, does it make a sound? More urgently, if scholars of and from the region are arrested, denied visas, deported, or is more and more the case, it seems, denied permission to attend international conferences or co-publish with their Western colleagues, quite how is that intellectual creativity to trump self-censorship? Such issues and the impact they're having on our field have been an object of considerable discussion, and it's at conferences such as this and in the margins, and in the work, say, of the CES Task Force on Fieldwork Safety. But there's another related issue for diagnosing the health of area studies, and it's this that I'm going to focus on, which has to do with the label itself. As Diane Conkerwell put it, area studies has become a dirty word in American, indeed in broader Anglophone academia, and I quote, labelled a relic of the Cold War that serves no epistemological purpose in our globalised world. If the challenges we now face are trans-regional or global, challenges of climate change, environmental degradation, of mass migration, of health and educational inequalities, of religious and secular fundamentalisms in their various guises, of digital militarism and online surveillance, then the question goes, what value is area studies? An approach to the global that would seem by definition to be tied to arbitrary, or worse, geopolitically determinist framings of the world region. Is area studies necessarily destined to be parochial and particularistic? In my own discipline of anthropology, the answer to that question often seems to be an implicit yes. I've often heard graduate students being encouraged to place their more ambitious scholarly articles in the high-hitting disciplinary journals that are likely to land them jobs, while treating area studies publications as a repository for their merely empirical contributions. Indeed, I've sometimes heard it used as a term of distanciation or a way of damning with faint praise. Well, he's more of an area studies person, being used to imply that he or she doesn't really do theory, is somehow unable of moving beyond the specific to the general. Is reimagining area studies then akin to resuscitating a dead dog, unpleasant, sad, and destined to fail? I'm not sure, but I think we need to try, precisely because the need for nuanced, informed voices about the region could not be greater. But if we're to make the case for the value of what we do, we need, I think, to critically interrogate the category of area itself. That is to say, we need to find a way of uncoupling area studies from static, geographically determinist, territorially bounded readings of culture and political process. There are three aspects of the area in area studies that I want to interrogate. First, as a way of thinking space, area is intrinsically two-dimensional. The dictionary definition of area has the extent or measurement of a surface or piece of land. It treats space, in other words, as surface, and therefore isomorphic, as static, as a neutral plane of action, area here as the stage on which something takes place. Now, while we might not consciously invoke area in this literal sense every time we invoke area studies, I think that there is, implicit in a structuring of the globe into discrete cartographic spaces, a kind of flattening that goes on. It's striking, for instance, how many of the visual representations of the Central Eurasian region take the outline political map of the five post-Soviet states, or more if we include the Caucasus, as the visual form for representing where we work. Or how in each of the Central Asian states, the internally undifferentiated political map, usually floating as though dismembered from any regional context, becomes an icon for the state as such, alongside the flag or the coat of arms or the visage of the president. Here's one from the village where I was doing research this summer in Andarak. In fact, Andarak is nicely marked on this map of Kyrgyzstan, population 5,000. Those maps, the maps we operate with, would look really different if, for instance, our default mental map of Central Eurasia was a map, say, of population densities. Here's one of Tajikistan. Or of topography, or of river and canal networks, or of Twitter users. By starting with area rather than, say, with density of population or air connections, or with volume of mountainous terrain, say, or with time taken to reach two points, we operate with an implicit reading of area that privileges certain imaginations of space over others. And, as several scholars have pointed out, a reading of space that would see that place as uniquely dangerous, fragmented, or conflict-generating. Konfliktagilny. I've got another of these population maps, this one of China, and you can see just how the population of density of eastern China differs from that of Xinjiang, and again how this kind of would alter how we think about the spaces of China and of Xinjiang in relation to Central Asia. I mentioned a moment ago that the way that we tend to also portray the region as uniquely dangerous, fragmented, or conflict-generating. Consider, for instance, how the region gets advertised to prospective students in the US. Come to Central Asia to live in a yurt and learn about geopolitics and military positionings. We laugh, but I think these images are not, they have real effects. I want to dwell for a moment with the question of depth and terrain in particular. Other than those professionally trained to look below the ground's surface or into the air, we rarely think about the material three-dimensional aspects of space. As geographer Stuart Eldon has argued in a recent article, I quote, "We all too often think the spaces of geography as areas, not volumes. Territories are bordered, divided, and demarcated, but not understood in terms of height and depth." In his own work in the West Bank, Eldon has shown how the dynamics of unequal power can only be understood by looking three-dimensionally at the way that competing sovereignties cross-cut in networks of roads, say, which privilege some and block others, or of underground tunnels. Geopolitics, he argues, following architect A.L. Weismann, is, quotes, "a discourse which ignores the vertical dimensions of power by looking across rather than to cut through the landscape." This was the cartographic imagination inherited from the military and political spatialities of the modern state, end quote. That's a quote from Weismann, as quoted in Stuart Eldon. In the Central Eurasian region, one way that we might reimagine area studies three-dimensionally would consist in attending in a more detailed and consistent way with the social and political implications of this varied material configuration. Not just the obvious differences between mountains and lowlands and the kind of material politics that these enable, but also the way that politics is configured by the possibilities, the imaginations, the potentiality of what might lie just below the surface, or in the movement of things, or in the atmosphere. The anticipation of oil or gold or heavy metals, for instance. The prospect of becoming energy self-sufficient through the harnessing of hydraulic power. The anxieties that come from living in a seismic zone. Or the forms of mobilization that occur about the invisible harms of air and water pollution. Detailed attention to how such materialities configure the social can help shed new light, for instance, on how we think about the times and spaces of marginality, or the way that nature becomes central to the imagination of pristine nationhood, or the relationship, say, between online and offline violence, or to the mobilizing dynamics of protest. Let me bring in a couple of examples to elaborate what I mean. In his illuminating studies of highland Tibet, anthropologist Martin Saxer has shown how villages often characterized as marginal because of their geographical remoteness from centers of power and their closeness to imperial borders have in fact often played crucial roles as sites of trade and exchange. What this requires is a shift of focus from the border as barrier to the terrain that enables certain high mountain villages to prosper as passing points. Focusing on pathways instead of borders, Saxer argues, and I'm quoting here, amounts to a rotation of gaze by 90 degrees. This rotation, rather than inversion of perspective, brings into view new questions: the relationship between a pathway and its hinterland, and the interdependence and competition between pathways along a borderline. Saxer draws our attention to the importance of terrain for thinking about marginality, a category remarkably missing, I think, in many considerations of borders focused upon the borderland as site of social mixing. In a very different context, that of environmental protest in Kyrgyzstan, Amanda Wooden has demonstrated the importance of attending to the material properties of terrain for thinking about the potentialities and politics of prospective environmental disaster. And here is a map that I saw Amanda using in a recent presentation, which I'm using with her permission, which shows the extent of glacial retreat around the Kumtor mining zone in Kyrgyzstan. So Amanda has demonstrated the importance of attending to the material properties of terrain for thinking about the potentialities and politics of prospective environmental disaster. The fact, for instance, that Kumtor is an open-pit gold mine built upon a glacier, the only one in the world to date, a glacier that is shrinking at alarming speed, accelerated by the deposit of tailings from the mining operations. Wooden's research is relevant for our reimagining of area studies in a second respect too, for it not only challenges us to bring the material and the social into the same analytic frame, attentive to the movement of rocks and glaciers and ideas and images and laws and finance as much as those of people. It also requires us to question the boundedness of our area studies framings, our methodological regionalism, and the tendency to think the local and the international as at opposite ends of a scale of analysis, small to big, specific to general. Wooden's research shows how we cannot understand the Kumtor mining operation itself, the protests that surround it, and the implications for mining operations elsewhere, including other prospective glacial mining exploits in Greenland, without bringing multiple other internationals into our frame of analysis from the start. Area, in other words, can never be reduced to bounded space. The spaces of local politics are always already mediated by life beyond. But there's a further twist here, which has to do with specificity and context. Understanding the meanings of marginality for yak herders and traders in highland Tibet, or the way that a melting glacier in rural Kyrgyzstan inserts into local cosmologies of space and time, or indeed the meanings of nationhood or democracy or protest itself, as say the meanings of opposition to an Uzbek opposition in exile, as Sarah Kendzior has shown, also depend on having the kind of long-term engagement in a region, the kind of language training, the kind of deep sensitivity to context that comes from having an area studies training. Wooden's research, for instance, has shown how the dynamics of local protest in Kyrgyzstan is inflected by enduring understandings of glaciers as sustaining social life, as having a spiritual as well as a material or economic value, just as they are by knowledge of global environmental protest movements and the power of social media. In my understanding, then, to pose the question in terms of a training that is either immersive and locally focused or international and comparative in scope is to pose the wrong question. We need a kind of area studies that resists the kind of reductive scalar thinking in which the international is seen as standing over and above the local. Or put differently, we need a perspective that recognizes the connections that that link a multiplicity of locals, whether that is the headquarters of the World Bank or a Kyrgyz mining village. Moreover, we need to remind those folks who work on North America or Western Europe and who feel no need to justify the specificity of their research site that they also do research that is local. In that sense, they also do area studies. It's just that their local tends not to be recognized as such. So area studies can be critiqued for treating space as two-dimensional, as area rather than volume, for fostering methodological regionalism, and for operating with a scalar view of the world in which the local is seen as being below the national or the regional or the international. There's a more profound kind of critique, though, that I think can be levelled at area studies, which is the tendency to treat stasis as prior to movement, analytically and empirically, or what Lisa Malke refers to as a sedentarist metaphysic. Let me try to explain what I mean. If we carve the world into geographically finite areas and treat this as our point of orientation, we're starting from an ontology of stasis. We might then ask, who or what is on the move? But being in place is our point of conceptual orientation. This kind of perspective is implicit in much of our language around migration. We talk of sending and receiving communities, of those on the move and those left behind, of departure and return. If we start with a perspective, however, in which we recognize people and things, including rocks and glaciers like this, and tectonic plates, are always on the move, just at different paces and in different orientations, some extremely slow and barely discernible, some extremely rapid, some oriented towards repetition, others towards innovation, then our optic subtly shifts. Doreen Massey talks about these movements as heterogeneous trajectories. Place in such a reading is nothing more than the provisional stabilization of such trajectories, a coming together, as she puts it, of stories so far. And I'm quoting here, "The vast differences in the temporalities of these heterogeneous trajectories, which come together in place, are crucial in the dynamics and appreciation of places. But in the end, there is no ground in the sense of a stable position. If we can't go back home, in the sense that it will have moved on from where we left it, then no more, and in the same sense, can we, on a weekend in the country, go back to nature. It too is moving on." Lest this perspective sound overly abstract or counterintuitive, then it's worth for a moment pausing with the way that movement is integral to social life. We might consider how, for instance, an absolute majority of families in some parts of Central Asia are materially tied to the possibility of one or more family working seasonally in Russia. The way that the memory of past movements, forced and voluntary, is integral to national imagination in parts of the region. Or the way that ideas of authenticity, cultural, spiritual, aesthetic, are themselves shaped by the movement of images, movies, fashions, religious texts, missionaries, academic literature, and so on. But movement is also there in the more mundane practices that sustain life and kinship, in the movement of women in marriage, of children to school and city, of water between fields for irrigation, of new families moving out to new land plots, of crops to market, of oil through transnational pipelines, and so on. Our very capacity to conceive of a stable point that is in place, having a home, having a point of return, having the predictability of things staying the same, that water will flow when I turn on a tap, electricity will come on when I press a switch, is enabled by the possibility and fact of movement, as well, of course, by a complex infrastructural assemblage of pipes and wires and regulatory systems. This is significant, I think, because a sedentarist metaphysic abounds, whether in attempts by parliamentarians to limit the international mobility of unmarried women in Kyrgyzstan, in nationalist rhetorics that would assume that one ethnic group has a more authentic attachment to place than another, or closer to my own home, in alarmist public discourses around floods of migrants on the move. I think it has implications more specifically for area studies and for the ways that we might pose our questions. Let me again try to illustrate with two examples. Anthropologist Magnus Marsden has spent the last few years following Afghan traders as they move between commodity markets in China and retail centres in Moscow, Kiev, Odessa, Dubai, and a variety of sites in post-Soviet Central Asia. Many of these men, and it is mostly men, have lived for many years as refugees in Pakistan. Although we might speak of these men as from Afghanistan, their linguistic fluency, their trade networks, their habitus, their ability to move on when things don't work out in one place, need to be situated both within historical legacies of transregional trading networks and in more immediate histories of war and displacement. Moreover, attentiveness to such networks allows us to reconfigure sites of seeming marginality, and Afghanistan is often treated as multiply marginal in area studies frameworks, not quite South Asia, not quite Central Asia, and not quite the Middle East. It allows us to see these as in fact nodes of connectivity constituted by communities of circulation. As Marsden puts it, quote, work on such trans-regional circulations has shown that scholarship that treats regions as fixed geographical categories tends to reduce the status of intermediary locales such as Afghanistan to that of marginal borderlands. As a result, there has been insufficient recognition of the ways in which such trans-regional contexts and their inhabitants have acted both historically and in the present as corridors of connectivity that forge links between apparently disconnected spaces. Moreover, following such movements close up, again drawing on long-term local language fieldwork, enables us to unsettle our conventional understandings of scale, of connectivity, of which places we imagine as being local to which others. My second example comes from the work of Emil Nasridinov and his team of anthropology undergraduates at the American University Central Asia. Emil and his colleagues conducted research among migrant workers from Kyrgyzstan in Kazan and St. Petersburg. Among other things, they were interested in understanding migrants' own lived geographies and how these differed between the two cities. Highlighted here in yellow is one of these maps that they accumulated, several of them, in which the market kind of figures, and it's this recurrent figure of kind of orientation in mental maps when people were asked, in this case, for instance, to draw a map of Kazan or a map of St. Petersburg. What emerged from their remarkable research is both the centrality of the market to lives and imaginaries of migrant traders in the city, and the way that migrants' habitual geographies intersected or not with those of local residents, feeding in Kazan and St. Petersburg to contrasting perceptions of risk among non-migrant populations in both cities. This, I think, is a vivid empirical illustration of Doreen Massey's call to think of space as lively, not as an intrinsic given, not as a stage for social action, but as the fragile provisional outcome of stories so far. Those stories are always diverse and multiple. The story that this map tells is different from the story of the tourist map, just as the political map of Central Asia does different work from a map of trader trajectories. The politically urgent question, of course, is which of these perspectives is privileged in our own scholarship. So where does all of this leave area studies? If, as I have suggested, area studies tends to rest upon a reductive and flattening account of space, one that treats space as surface, the international above the local, and stasis as prior to movement, should we abandon it altogether? Should we, as Stephen Hansen argues, find a less Cold War-ish term, not to mention one that perhaps has more traction among prospective students attentive to what will land them a job? Maybe. But shifting name without interrogating how we think about space and scale and the ways that we might adequately do justice to lives lived between doesn't necessarily solve the problem. In particular, the suggestion that we replace area studies with global and regional studies, to me, risks throwing the baby out with the bathwater, or perhaps not even getting rid of the bathwater itself. For it still implies that there is a regional and then there is the global. Two scales, one little, one big, the former impacting upon the latter. Whereas what I've been trying to argue is for an optic attentive to the way that every local, those that mark Central Asian landscapes as much as the corridors of the World Bank, is always already global too, just as the seeming sites of global power are also local, also specific, also constituted by particular historical, geopolitical, and economic configurations. In this sense, even the celebrated non-spaces of airports, shopping malls, and so on are saturated with particular configurations of economic and political power. We perhaps don't notice them as such because most of these so-called non-spaces are spaces of capitalist consumption par excellence. What we need, I think, is not so much a rejection of area studies, but a repurposing of area, starting with a critical interrogation of the spatial metaphors that organise our field, and perhaps some playful experimentation with some more lively readings of space. We need to do for area what queer studies has done for queer, by illuminating heteronormativity, or whiteness studies has done to expose white privilege by calling out its centrality and exposing its invisibility. We need to illuminate how the production of space is itself linked to the articulation of power, or how our spatial metaphors, think of Silk Roads, pivots, great games, giant chessboards, imperial backyards, near abroads, and so on, are implicated in these uneven structurings. In my final few minutes, I want to suggest three examples, and these are three among many possible, of approaches through which such an interrogation of area might occur. These are not intended to be exhausted, and are approaches that emerge from the specificity of my own empirical research on the remaking of borders in the Fergana Valley and transnational labour migration between Central Asia and Russia. There are other such metaphors. The attention to offshoring, for instance, with which Heathershaw and Cooley have prompted us to think about the spaces of Central Asian power, or the category of territorial imaginary through which Natalie Koch has explored the remaking of urban space in Kazakhstan. First, I suggest we need an attentiveness to traces. Trace is both a spatial metaphor and a temporal one. It alludes on the one hand to movement through a landscape, we traced a path, and at the same time it references the way that the past continues to inhabit, inflect, or haunt the present. Traces attest to something never quite erased, but not entirely present either. We might think of the traces of past modernist or imperial projects that can be found in Central Eurasian landscapes, the junkyards of futures past, as de Genova calls them. Or we might think of the traces of past histories of trade, past practices of honouring the dead, past ways of sacralising landscape that are present, for instance, in the names given to food, in the material forms of burial grounds, or in the names given to villages and sacred sites. In a very different context, anthropologist Michael Taussig has studied the colonial history of indigo, the colour used to make jeans blue. The history of indigo, he shows, is inseparable from a history of colonial trade, the traces of which are present in the very words that we use in English. So what does this approach allow? Firstly, it is a focus attentive to the way that the present never entirely erases the past, what Alice Street has called the unplanned historicity of place. Rather than treating space and sovereignty as bounded and tied to the state, a focus on traces allows us to think about overlapping geographies and hybrid sovereignties, and about the land less as surface than as palimpsest. Second, it allows us to see how these past projects, past ways of conceiving place, interrupt at attempts at remaking space. And I think a good example of this at the moment are protests going on in Tajikistan against the remaking of the center of Dushanbe. Let me try to illustrate with a concrete example, this time from my own research. Contemporary border disputes in the Isfara Valley between Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan hang in large part on disputes about the recent past, specifically about the authority that is to be granted to past parity commissions, the maps they produced, and the decrees that ratified the decisions of such committees in one Soviet Union republic, but not the other. Currently, disputes over delimitation and demarcation in the Isfara Valley, and the areas here in yellow indicate the places where Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan disagree over the boundaries of nation states, currently disputes over delimitation and demarcation hinge precisely on the authority to be accorded to different past moments. Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan refer to different maps and different normative acts as authoritative. Yet what is striking when you dig into the history of contemporary border tensions is the way that the present here is haunted by the past, materially and ideationally. This is reflected, for instance, in the way that local understandings of border are inflected by the memory of past land exchanges during the post-war era that are recalled as unfair or corrupt. It's reflected, too, in the curious repetition that is found in the wording of parity commissions in the post-war period, right up until the 1980s, emphasising the need to overcome past mistakes and the danger of conflict if such disputes are not resolved. In short, we need to attend to the way that geography itself has a history, that border and delimitation here are haunted by a multiplicity of attempts at reordering space, and by the memory that borders here haven't tended to stay stable for long. We can't understand the passion and anxiety that attaches to new borderland construction in this region, for instance, or road and other infrastructure projects without taking this history into account. A second idiom that I think we can productively explore to reimagine space is that of trajectory. If area focuses our attention on space as bounded, trajectory precisely alludes to the stories so far of which Massey writes. Trajectories direct our attention to movement and to limits upon movement. In the Central Eurasian region, there is, I think, some fantastic work looking at the trajectories and itineraries of migrant workers, commodity traders, international development workers, religious missionaries, students, craftsmen, pilgrims, and others. There is also some great work in progress looking, for instance, at the movement of religious and other knowledge, of sacred sites, sacred objects, of forms of certification, of new building styles, of laws, including some of the more draconian laws against religious freedom or so-called gay propaganda, and of religious apparel. This work, I think, has the potential to interrogate our area studies' framings of the world from below by pointing to the forms of connectivity between East, Central, and West Asia in particular that cannot be contained within a traditional area studies frame. This is also the kind of literature that has the potential to unsettle some of the categories that have been developed within the context of that area studies literature by exploring, for instance, new modes of Muslim sociality that emerge in transnational trading contexts, new forms of hostility and hospitality that accompany, say, the growing presence of Chinese traders or construction workers in the cities of Central Asia, emergent modes of consumption grounded in aesthetics of Islamic piety coming from Turkey and the Middle East, or new forms of online organizing that cross national and regional boundaries. It also draws attention to the effortful work entailed in stabilizing space, making borders stick. Finally, I think we need a more variegated and temporally differentiated account of the state and sovereignty. That is, we need a more differentiated account of how and why certain ways of making or transforming space come to dominate and exclude others, how and when we become aware of whose rules rule, and how we might account empirically and theoretically for spaces where the state is experienced as absent or failing or non-sovereign. Rather than a geography structured by spatial contiguity and isomorphism, the border, the line demarcating the limits of state sovereignty, we need, I think, a spatial imaginary attentive to points of emergence and intensity, to points of conflict and contestation, or what I have called in the title pressure points. In her study of botulism in Georgia, for instance, geographer Elizabeth Dunn has shown how understanding the presence of this fatal condition is inseparable from an account of the state in retreat. Botulism, she argues, and I quote, indexes places where the state has failed, and where the disciplinary practices of neoliberalism seem unable to take hold. The Georgian state allows a way of interrogating the twin claims that states are both mythic and omnipresent. Again, what this requires is slow, steady, grounded, empirical work to unpack those sites of intensification or differentiation of competing sovereignty claims or of state failure. Why border crossings occur here, why protests occur there, why this place has become central to national imaginaries, why this hospital gets bombed, and so on. The political stakes of such a varied account of space and sovereignty are not insignificant. This work is already occurring. Indeed, the examples that I have referenced here from geographers, anthropologists, political scientists and others show that there is plenty of critical and thoughtful interrogation of ethno-territorial essentialisms in our field. What is striking to me, though, is that most of these critiques have occurred not on the pages of area studies journals, but in disciplinary publications. The conversations are not yet occurring across and between disciplines. More importantly, I think, they haven't yet produced the kind of reclaiming or repurposing of area studies that I think is needed if we are to be able to demonstrate our relevance to a social science mainstream that would cast area studies as defunct or merely parochial. In the past, we have tended to stress the importance of Central Eurasia studies by referring to some intrinsic importance of the region. Look, we really are central. Or worse, to highlight the importance of this region to strategic or military concerns. Look, you need our expertise for your war on terror. To me, these approaches risk reproducing a binary in which area studies can only stake the grounds of its significance on considerations of localism and particularity. As such, we stay trapped in the winds of geopolitical forces, such that our scholarly fortunes are hinged to whether the US State Department thinks our region is strategic or not. I think we need something more ambitious, a reclaiming of area that would illuminate the provincialisms that structure so much scholarship, including that of the social science mainstream. On this, though, I am cautiously hopeful. For our field is still small enough, experimental enough, and I think collegiate enough for us to have these kinds of conversation and to articulate a defence of area studies adequate to the challenges, conceptual, empirical and political, of our time. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah. We now have time, after this magistral lecture, now have time for question and comments and kind of large discussion. So please, yeah, if you can introduce yourself.
I can introduce myself, John Sherberlein, Kazakhstan. Thank you very much for a wonderful talk. It's so rich and so much in there. And you make a very compelling argument for a different intellectual approach, one that I think people have been asking for a time. But I mean, it's not absolutely new, but yet it seems very urgent, especially in our part of the world. But it seems to me that if you're going to make an argument that's meant to change the way that our field works in the scholarly landscape, which is structured not just by our intellectual agendas, but by a lot of power structures, then in a sense, I mean, you're asking to do something that's really quite subversive. You're asking us to talk about whose rules rule when other people want different rules to rule, right, than the ones that you're suggesting should be the agenda. And my question is, I mean, if this is meant to be a recipe for avoiding Sarah's eulogy, the necessity of Sarah Kendzior's eulogy to Central Eurasian studies, then how do we make this kind of argument, which is intellectually compelling, also politically powerful? I mean, you're asking us to question all the givens, right? I mean, the conceptualizations of sovereignty, which are so determinative of how scholarship is structured, for example. I hope I've made my question clear. Thank you.
Shall I answer straight away, or do you want to collect?
No, I think you can answer.
Okay, thanks. Thank you, John. That's a great question to which I can't really do justice. But how do we make it politically powerful? I mean, and politically compelling. I think there are kind of two ways to try and respond to that. I think one is that our scholarship needs to kind of be compelling in its own terms. So we should be, and I think that good scholarship is in a sense subversive very often. It is subversive to how we think, you know, to conventional accounts of power or of sovereignty or of how things don't work the way that we assume. And I think, you know, some of the best literature in Central Asia has that, on Central Eurasia, has that kind of quality. So I think that we shouldn't be posing our research questions through the analytical categories that are necessarily kind of those presented by you know, the Washington Beltway, let's say. But on the other hand, I think, you know, then there is the risk that we're simply, you know, having a conversation among ourselves that has that is completely divorced in a sense from those who really, you know, who hold power in a very significant sense. And I think part of the way of responding to that is by being very explicit about the ways that these alternative framings or these alternative ways, for instance, of thinking about the spatial extent of sovereignty, let's say, actually have real implications for those engaged in various governmental projects or various non-governmental projects, or the ways that, for instance, perhaps well-intentioned, well-meaning interventions, let's say in the realm of conflict prevention, for instance, may end up actually reproducing certain of the distinctions that they would want to contest or certain of the stereotypes that they would want to overcome because of the ways that they operate, for instance, with certain kinds of readings of place, certain readings of place, for instance, as being inherently conflict-agenly, inherently conflict-generating. So I think part of the task is also trying to communicate that these conversations, although they are conversations in a sense pitched at the level of our analytical categories, also have real implications for the kinds of ways that that certain questions get posed and the ways that certain interventions get framed and potentially the way that those interventions could be done differently or more creatively. And it's, of course, it's not, you know, a straightforward process, but I think having, you know, having an argument for the ways that interrogating analytical categories isn't simply a sort of an ivory tower kind of pastime, but actually has real implications for the ways that questions get posed, interventions get articulated, and so forth. Whether people, you know, whether those in power will listen is, of course, another question. I've got David Montgomery and then David Levy. Yeah.
Thanks, Madeline. David Montgomery, Communities Engaging with Difference in Religion, I guess.
Sorry?
I was trying to get my identification.
Oh, sorry. I'm trying to answer
as well as anybody else. So where do you, sort of following up in some ways on John's question, but where do you see the biggest challenge is in terms of imagining area studies to be something different than what it is? Is it the researchers or is it something else? What I mean is that if we were to imagine the university as being relevant, as being less concerned with knowledge of things but knowledge for things, right, sort of a particular problem, area studies would be a great way of doing it, right, because you can look at a problem, you have a larger container with which you could bring people doing interdisciplinary work together and actually do it rather than just talk about it. But yet there are the structural challenges of departments that are increasingly having to reify what they are as an anthropology department or political science department or whatever, not encouraging movement around sort of the very types of interdisciplinary creativity that everyone says they want, which would then, of course, you know, seem to make it a bit more relevant, and area studies would make sense. But where do you sort of see the challenges or the pushes are? Is this something that the researchers do? Is this something that is more structural, as John was sort of touching upon?
Thanks. Another great question. That in a sense, it's, you know, I think precisely the structures are the challenges are structural and institutional, and that makes addressing them very, very, you know, very real. They can't, you know, they can't simply be kind of washed away or deconstructed. But I think one thing that we can do is make a more articulate and concerted defense of the value of area studies that isn't simply, well, we need knowledge about this little region that, you know, that is strategic, but that actually that area studies can be, that it doesn't have to be either you do, you know, something that is theoretically informed or something that will push forward, let's say, a disciplinary conversation, or you do area studies. And I think it's striking to me, I've been paying attention to this as I've been sort of working on this paper, how often area studies is invoked in disciplinary conversations as a sort of poor relative. And I think actually reminding those people who do research in the centers of power that they also do a kind of area studies is a really important part of that. And making a kind of argument for the ways that the sort of empirical and nuanced studies that emerge, let's say, from the study of a particular issue or problem can really inform those wider theoretical debates as well. So I think kind of making the argument in those terms, and for me, I mean, I referenced several people's research here that I think are doing that in really innovative ways. So Amanda Wooden's research, she's in an environmental studies program, but I think that kind of research that can really actually, that is making, you know, theoretical interventions within a very particular disciplinary framework is informed by and could only be possible because Amanda has that, you know, long-term, immersive, detailed kind of knowledge that comes from long engagement with the field, local language knowledge and so forth, and a real attentiveness to the way that local categories of analysis, let's say, might be different from those, you know, being invoked in comparable situations. So I mean, I agree. I think the challenges are really structural. And like I said, you know, the lack of hiring in, you know, an area studies field is part of the challenge that we face. But I think constantly trying to kind of articulate the value of what we do that isn't simply reverting to the kind of, well, the intrinsic importance of this region in some geopolitical terms is one possible kind of way to add to that. I think David Levy was next. Yeah.
David Levy, Boston University. Thank you for such a wonderful presentation, Madeline. I was wondering, and I really appreciate this idea of moving beyond this, you know, local versus, you know, global level, you know, a distinction. But if we're to try, and can you offer a kind of really alternate conceptual language for when you say, you know, here's what interests me, here's what I'm working on, but this is the case, and here's what I'm generalizing from that case, right? Just the whole global regional. Distinction again. This is the topic that's very interesting to me. This is the really important, you know, case I'm studying, and here's then the generalizability of that case. And that just simply reproduces exactly what you're saying we have to challenge. Is there a kind of alternate language available?
I think being very conscious of the ways that we use these categories of local, regional, national, international, and the way, I mean, you know, the way, for instance, that we tend to reproduce often in our academic scholarship, the distinction between, you know, local and international, let's say, experts, right? You know, there are local experts and there are international experts, as though somehow these operate, you know, on different planes of kind of generalizability and so forth. So I think, again, it's partly about an attentiveness to the kinds of categories that we use and the political work that they do. And I think it's also about thinking imaginatively about the ways that we might generalize and the kinds of generalizations that we make and the kinds of comparisons that we might do. So part of the constraints that are posed by a sort of an area studies framing of the world is that it tends to limit the kinds of comparisons that we might take. So for instance, you know, for thinking about, let's say, the variegated nature of state sovereignty in the Central Eurasian region, it might be that actually Central America or parts of sub-Saharan Africa are really, you know, the kinds of vibrant comparisons that we should be engaging in, or for thinking about, you know, the stakes of transnational labor migration and exploitation of migrant workers, actually thinking about transnational labor migration between Southeast Asia and the Middle East, right, might be actually the kind of comparison that might be really compelling. So I think sort of being conscious of the way that these area studies framings also shape very often the kinds of comparisons that we make, and the kinds of, so that when we make that claim of generalizability, to what are we generalizing, right? So that, you know, and with what are we comparing, and what are the kinds of claims that bringing perhaps other sorts of comparisons together might enable us to foster. There's a question at the back.
Hello, I am Dushan Shamata from Kyrgyzstan, and I have a question about the benefits of our scholarship to the common people in Central Asia. Because a long time ago in my life, I made a choice to go to foreign language department, and that's why today I'm here among the learned people. However, majority of the people are still in the villages, and could you share some of your ideas about some of the more immediate, deliberate, purposeful, and innovative approaches that a common person in Central Asia can benefit from our scholarship? Thank you.
Thanks. I think that's a really, again, a really important and a really urgent kind of question, because, again, very often we have our conversations at some sort of, it seems we occupy some kind of ivory tower. The first thing I'd want to say is that I think we all speak from somewhere, and I think that's one important kind of way of how might our research be relevant to people in Central Asia who aren't able to access, let's say, these kinds of discourses that are taking place in English. I think there are some very concrete things that we can do. I think publishing in local language scholarship, for instance, and engaging in conversations with academics, with other kinds of concerned individuals in the context where we do research. But I think one of the arguments I'd want to make is that many of the, let's say, if we take your example of people living in villages in Central Asia, in several of the villages where I've done research in Central Asia, people are profoundly impacted by decisions being made, let's say, by the executives of USAID or the Department for International Development or by Mercy Corps, as well as by the interventions or the initiatives of the local government and the national government in those particular contexts. So I think, again, actually reflecting on the kinds of ways that policies and programs actually impact upon the poorest people in society, whether that is in relation to, let's say, how migrant work is regulated or how migrant workers are discriminated against or the kinds of obstacles that people might face now as a result of changes in legislation. I think kind of actually thinking about how our research might, in some sense, inflect those debates by bringing more nuanced kinds of perspectives. And I think that is, you know, so I think there are different levels and different ways that those kinds of conversations can be had. There's, of course, also an ethic of engagement when we do, say, field work in a village setting, at the level of kind of human interaction, right? I think that these ethical considerations operate in all sorts of domains in terms of our scholarly practice, from how we behave when we're doing field work to where we publish to whom we try to speak. But I think always kind of bearing in mind how scholarship can potentially impact upon, you know, the poorest people in society who don't necessarily have access to these kinds of conversations, it's critically important. And I think there are some, you know, significant avenues of that, in particular through engagement with local scholarly communities. I think that's a really important kind of dimension. Morgan?
I have a microphone.
Oh, sorry, Jean, maybe you go first.
Sorry, go.
I was looking in the wrong direction.
Yeah, thank you so much. I was also wanting to ask about how this would sound to institutions where Central Asia studies is all that is done, that is, in Central Asia quite often. But I think that question is answered. But I also wanted to point to a sort of larger picture of there being a real crunch on the humanities in general and on social sciences. And I think the crunch on area studies is a symptom of that. Mm-hmm. And how can we can reposition that entire field without becoming giving labels of identity, you know, creators of identity. So, yeah.
Thanks. I feel like I'm getting a this is the problem with doing a kind of polemical talk, is that I feel I don't have adequate responses to to any of the questions, because indeed, you know, there's a kind of crisis of the humanities and a crisis of social sciences and the crisis of what counts as meaningful scholarship that extends beyond the area studies field, right? The demand for a certain kind of evidence-based scholarship, for instance, that privileges certain kinds of quantifying normative sorts of scholarship, and that tends to sideline anything that is exposing nuance or complexity or, you know, specificity and so forth. And if, you know, if I had a fix for, I don't know, the crisis of funding for the social sciences, say, in my country, I would be a very happy person. But I think all we can continue to do is to really make claims for the value of this sort of scholarship within a broader social science community. So why area studies research matters within a broader social science community, and why social science matters and why the humanities matter within an academic community more generally. And I think part of that, for instance, in, let's say, the field that I'm most familiar with in anthropology, is in a willingness to speak to audiences that we might not conventionally be used to speaking to. So I think that's also part of that story of defending the social sciences, is that anthropologists in particular, I think, are often very wary of trying to generalize from their research, precisely because often what we're pointing to is the kind of, you know, the specificity and the particularity of the particular context that we're studying. But I think having a willingness actually to try to communicate to an audience that's not familiar why this might be important or why this might be valuable is one way we can do that. And that would mean, you know, engaging in the forms of, say, public anthropology, let's say, but I think public social science that is actually very well developed in certain contexts. I'm really impressed in Scandinavia, for instance, how the willingness with which anthropologists communicate in the public domain, which in Britain is much more rarely the case. So I think there are spaces where those conversations can happen. Morgan.
Is it Morgan? Hi, Morgan, Ohio State University. Madeline, it seems to me that your call to take down the boundary, the categories of area, has to come with it also a call to take down the boundaries between disciplines. Because not only was your talk extremely interdisciplinary, but you're asking all of us to examine some of these frames of ways of framing that you've, I think, demonstrated pretty convincingly has some effects that in the real world, in our way of looking at the real world, and that it could apply to everybody. But at the same time, I sort of hesitate because I wanted to ask you, because I'm trying to channel what I think many people in this room might be thinking. Maybe I'm being presumptuous, but your talk was a very anthropological talk. And a lot of people are saying, I can't do that. Because different disciplines have different investments in their frameworks, and the stakes are you actually alluded to some of them in your talk. For example, I advise a political science student in Central Asian Studies, and on the committee, I sometimes have to hold back and I have to defer to the rest of the committee in political science, realizing that there's things I think I can't say to my student because she needs to get a job after she graduates and apply for funding and so forth. So I'm wondering, what are the limits of interdisciplinary, honestly, even in a small community like this? I don't need to be conflicto genni with that. but just to be honest.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, the sort of question of, well, what about the realities of the market in which people, you know, are trying to apply for jobs certainly in a North American context, I think, where political science, for instance, has a very particular kind of privileging of certain kinds of methods and approaches is really significant. And I think it's significant for anybody, you know, advising as you say. But I think and my, you know, my call is not that we should all become anthropologists, or it's only partly that we should all become anthropologists. But I think you know, and a lot of the examples that I was trying to reference are not those of anthropological scholarship, but where I think the power, let's say, of the contribution, let's say, to a debate within sociology, a debate within political science, can also derives from the fact that there is an attentiveness to the specificity of particular circumstances, right, that would make us hesitant about employing broad kinds of generalizing categories. And I think that's where that conversation across disciplines can be really valuable. It's not a call to abandon a kind of quantifying or a generalizing approach, but it's an awareness that, for instance, when we invoke religious identity, I gave that example as some scholarship that I'm familiar with, which would reduce that to a sort of a variable that can be quantified, that can be measured, that can be incorporated into a quantifying model, often rests upon certain kinds of implicit understandings of how you would measure, for instance, a person's religiosity, and how you would draw, and what kinds of conclusions might be drawn from that quantitative measure, that variable, to, and I've seen this happen with some scholarship, to assumptions about the possibilities for radicalization, for instance, that make, in other words, kind of generalizing leaps, because of the need to generalize and to specify, that actually I think there's real room to kind of interrogate the way that those logical leaps are taking place. And I think that that is one place where actually having a conversation across disciplines can be really valuable. So I think, you know, it's not a call to abandon a sort of more quantifying social science, but it is a reflection on the way that I think the claims of quantifying social science can be nuanced by recognizing the specificity of context. And I think that's what a lot of really good social science in our region actually really demonstrates within political science, you know, that I read. And I think the value, I mean, as I said right at the end, I think one of the things that I really appreciate about our field is that it's still small enough that the anthropologists and the political scientists and the historians and the sociologists read each other. And I think that's actually quite unusual in a lot of fields. And I think that's something that we can really we can really take advantage of by having those conversations about how and why, you know, our perspectives on something like ethnicity or identity or, you know, religious identification, let's say, might be at odds with each other. I don't know. Ali, so I saw Ali next.
Ali Iman, California State University. Thanks, Madeline, for a talk that challenged us quite a bit. I think the conversation maybe needs to also include the ways in which we teach. For example, in my department, history department, we are trying to move away from, although this is proving to be very difficult, from the regional categories. So people who are doing Asian history are trying to say, okay, I'm working really on cultural history. Why can't I actually teach, you know, combine my expertise in Asia with something else? Mm. And the students are actually really liking this idea because they are finding it difficult to be just doing American history or, you know, if they're, we train lots of high school teachers and high school in California, high schools require them to be, you know, Americanists plus world historians. Mm. And everything else is difficult for them to get jobs. So I think when we are talking about our research and, you know, how we can be interdisciplinary or actually we are challenging these area studies ideas or, you know, in different ways, we should also think about maybe how we teach. And it seems like sometimes when we do focus on the research, we are sort of not thinking about the teaching side of it. I don't know if you want to address that. Thank you.
Thanks, Ali. Yeah, I don't really have much to add because I absolutely agree. I think my primary identity is as a teacher, at least at the moment. And these questions, I think, are really, you know, for me the teaching and the scholarship are never kind of these two separate domains. But I appreciate that when you're training, for instance, future high school teachers, I think that's a fantastic kind of example of a kind of cohort with whom you can really do that work in a sense of destabilizing the assumption that there are certain you know, kind of dominant narratives or dominant histories or dominant foci when it comes to history. I mean, when I was an undergraduate in Cambridge University, the history department still used to run a course called, with no irony, The West and the Rest. You know, and I think the kind of capacity actually for the kind of scholarship that we do to and the kind of teaching that we do to also precisely encourage students and prospective teachers to interrogate the ways that a whole host of implicit geopolitical imaginaries and geographical imaginaries kind of inflect the way that we talk about world regions, right? Where is center? Where is periphery? You know, when we think about, you know, the great game, when we think about the great, you know, the giant chessboard, or when we think about the Silk Road, what kinds of geographical imaginaries, what kinds of implicit structuring of the world are being invoked in these things? And how might, you know, for instance, prospective high school teachers actually encourage their own students in school to really reflect on the kind of habitual, you know, Eurocentrisms or US centrisms that kind of often, you know, I think particularly inflect the way that histories get taught. There was a whole, I think, yeah, I don't know who was next. I think there was a lady at the back there with
glasses. Look at this side of the room too.
Yeah, sorry, sorry.
Eventually.
So we'll start in the back.
I'm a bit of an accidental tourist in area studies because I'm a humanities person, I'm a literature person, I'm a creative writer, and so it's very, and I didn't know it was just social science.
It's not.
Right. So it's funny to keep hearing that. So my question is when you were talking at some point about, you know, the spaces we're studying are the stories that have been told so far about them. And the so far is important, right? Because the idea that narrative is malleable and it redetermines all the time what we're seeing and what we're saying. So I'm kind of curious about the humanities in this whole thing and thinking about how, okay, stories are not the province of the humanities, certainly, and history ends up in different schools depending on the university or whatever, humanities or social science. But we are people who study narrative a lot, and we study a lot about, you know, how people tell stories about themselves, including how social scientists might tell stories about themselves and what they do and everything. So I'm curious, how might the humanities help with a sort of rethinking of the story we tell about what area studies is? Like, how might some of the things, I mean, for us, and sorry, I don't want to go on too long, but just that, and I type this because I get nervous talking, but narrative, stories are inherently highly imaginary, continually reconfigurable spaces. That's what they are. And that's what it sounds to me like you're trying to talk about the world as. It's not unhinged from local and particular, et cetera, at all, but very movable pieces. So humanities and area studies. Not just about defending the humanities, but what's the place of humanities in this new area studies? Mm.
Thank you.
Alison Mandeville.
Thank you, Alison. That's your critique is very well taken. I mean, in a sense, I think you provided the answer, actually, or you know, I think part of the answer about where the humanities are in this story is precisely in illuminating that narrative and imaginary, and I would add to that, let's say, the affective and emotional components of social life are not merely some kind of extraneous component, but are actually integral to the ways that we frame, let's say, political problems, to the ways that we imagine space. And I think you're quite right that kind of attending more explicitly to those narrative forms and therefore kind of, you know, engaging more explicitly with the ways, for instance, that within different literary or imaginative or traditions, or within different kinds of realms of the humanities or the realms of the performing arts or the applied arts might actually also give us kinds of ways into thinking about how space gets done, or how histories get imagined, or how ethnicity becomes seen as tied to place, and so forth, in ways that can be, you know, I think, really creatively done. And again, I think there are some really, within our field, I think there are some really excellent examples of that. There's a recent collection published by the French Institute for Central Asian Studies on literature in Central Asia, which is really, again, really is a conversation between scholars of literature and social scientists, or those who would describe themselves as social scientists, which is engaging in a very creative way around questions of identity and memory and history, for instance. So I think, yeah, you know, your point is really well taken.
Yes, David Abramson, State Department. So I'm coming at this from a partly different perspective, although I also have one foot in scholarship when I can. And since you mentioned engaging, you invoked the State Department in U.S. foreign policy, you also invoked engaging audiences that that academics don't traditionally engage with or are not as comfortable engaging with. So I was just thinking about how you would apply this to one of the central questions here in terms of interest in the region. Now, to the extent that we accept this as a region, I feel like 2 years ago, prior to 2014 and everything that was talked about, the effects of that the U.S. government would stop being interested in the region, and I'm not speaking on behalf of the U.S. government, they would have a different demeanor and answer in talking about this. But I feel like there are three draws for the United States' attractions to Central Asia that did not exist 3 years ago or were not on people's radar screens. One is China's interest, economic influence, growing influence in the region, the rise of ISIL and its presence in Afghanistan, and Russia's foreign policy shift and growing activity not only in the former CIS, but beyond that. Now, maybe for the wrong reasons or the right reasons, these are three things that didn't exist 2 years ago that are, I think, are attracting a lot of interest in Washington to this region. So I think the claims about the loss of interest in the region or in Central Asian area studies is no longer the case. I mean, we'll see how Congress responds to this with the money they appropriate for these projects. So I'm wondering how you would apply this thinking in responding to this particular foreign policy audience, not necessarily in this room because it's mostly an academic conference, but how you would apply that to this.
Thanks. It's very interesting to hear about these shifts, and I'm a long way from the kind of Washington Beltway, so it's kind of interesting that that you mentioned this kind of renewed interest. And in one sense, it's not surprising, but I think it provides precisely the kind of forum within which we can demonstrate actually the need for a nuanced and very balanced and very empirical and very subtle and very thoughtful, considered approach to studying the region. So, for instance, I mean, the case of the rise of or the potential attractions of ISIL for young men, especially from Central Asia, I think that's a case where, in fact, there is some really interesting, I know Noah Tucker's been doing some really interesting kind of empirical research on this, which has the potential also to kind of challenge and contest a lot of the knee-jerk assumptions about, again, the kind of relationship, let's say, between renewed interest in expressions of Islamic piety, for instance, and the likelihood that somebody is going to join ISIL. And, you know, David Montgomery and John Heathershaw have also done some really interesting work on this. And I think it illuminates the point that I've been trying to make, precisely kind of contesting the way that we might assume X from Y, right? So we might assume that renewed expressions of Muslim piety is likely to or creates the conditions within which more people might be motivated to join ISIL, right? And that's a kind of claim that you sometimes read, which ignores the significance of understanding domestic context, the kind of importance of the role of local authoritarianisms, the kind of, the closure of the Islamic Renaissance Party in Tajikistan, et cetera, et cetera. So I think actually this kind of conversation is really important precisely to bring the kind of nuance, very often the role of scholars in these conversations is to say, hang on a moment, it might not be as straightforward as this. You know, hang on a moment, the story might be more complicated for these and these and these reasons. Or the kind of causal link that's being attributed actually might have a whole series of, you know, many more kind of complex underlying factors that haven't been accommodated. So I think, there is this space for having, you know, bringing the kind of nuanced scholarship to these sorts of conversations, and also, you know, contesting them where necessary, or contesting the kinds of assumptions that might be, let's say, inflecting U.S. foreign policy with Russia, for instance, and actually, you know, trying to bring some nuance to conversations that very often lack those, I think, within the public political domain. I know there's a bunch of people on this side who wanted to.
Hi, Jim Millward from Georgetown. And first of all, I'd like to recognize how interesting your sort of critique, or I guess more interrogation of area studies for its sort of intellectual constraints and epistemological problems and so on. Very interesting. Some of it, as I think someone said, it's not entirely new. We heard it at the end of the Cold War, right? Area studies is over. Everything's transnational and global now. Fine. And we saw how well that did, right? But you have, you know, much more interesting things to say, and you were analyzing space and so on. But that said, I'd kind of like to stage a defense of area studies on very traditional grounds that are also, I think, very practical. And first, why are they practical? The defunding of Central Asian studies, of area studies in general, which you've seen in the last few years, I don't think that's really the State Department. My contacts with State Department people, they're very interested in area studies. Likewise, you know, policy people in Washington, although I generally am, you know, hating them, what they want are people who know something about a place. So they don't want to hear about models. They don't have time for that. They want to know, you know, facts on the ground, and that's the think tank mentality, right? So I think the current round of defunding comes from the ideologues and clowns in Congress who don't recognize their own self-interest, clearly, right? You know, so that's why they like to shut government down after getting into it, right? So the problem is that's an irrational act on the part of irrational actors. It's hard to fit that in. No, but I think the way the history of area studies has been, it's a, you know, post-World War II, you know, carving up of the world into these boxes. Not entirely arbitrary. If you think about many of those boxes, they actually, although they contain, you know, sort of different cultural groups within East Asia, Europe, or, you know, the Soviet Union, they tend to correspond to scripts, interestingly enough, right? So you have sort of a Roman script area, you have a Cyrillic script area, you have an Arabic script area, you have a, Chinese sort of originally based area. Africa is out of that. But, you know, there's a civilizational division and arguably a racial division behind it. So this goes back to the myth of continents that Karen Wigan talked about and, you know, feeds into it. So that said, there are problems, of course, with that way of dividing up the world. But there are also advantages, and one of those comes, I think, from the focus on language, which has additionally been at the core of area studies. You didn't talk about that too much. But I think that's been what's most useful about it, because as a training vehicle, you bring people in, they spend years doing the language, and you learn about the regions where those languages are spoken, or the peoples who speak that language, wherever they are, right? And this is where the humanities is central, too. You do humanities courses, you do social science courses, you do everything about, you know, X. And I've been through, you know, places with those programs. I think pretty much everyone here has done that. So creating this model, and this model has been somewhat attenuated and lost, I think, in part because not all of academe, but in particular certain social sciences have moved away from that. You know, political science departments don't want to hire necessarily a China specialist, right? So much anymore. At the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown, they're constantly hiring area specialists outside of the government department, outside of the economics department, because those departments won't hire them. So they hire them in the School of Foreign Service. So anyway, that's not news to anyone here. But I think this, the attack on area studies, qua area studies, or the difficulties with it, are more within certain social science disciplines than they are across academia. So one more point. I think from the Vietnam War era, I think the academy has been very successful at taking the policy desires of government, particularly the U.S. government, and using them to create educational model and research model to a certain extent that allows for humanities and allows for a broad-based study of an empirical study of people's regions and so on, which is not necessarily what the policymakers would have decided themselves, but we've been able to at least to broaden it out and to create all sorts of academics who aren't necessarily out there thinking about how to win the next war. So, I agree with everything you said, and I love the way you analyzed it. I would say that strategically, we may be at a moment now when we should say we need to go back to area studies as the funders recognize it, as a way of getting more funding back in the door.
Thank you. Thanks, Jim. I think we're disagreeing less than you imply, actually. I mean, in the sense that I wanted to really pitch this as, in a way, as a defense of area studies, right? And I'm the associate editor of a journal that is defined by, you know, its area studies framing. I'm, in a sense, very, very invested in, you know, this kind of gathering, right? And apart from it just being fun to catch up with the other people who, you know where Ashgabat is when you talk about it and stuff, it's actually, you know, there's a kind of, there is an intellectual purpose to this. My point was not to say I think we should kind of abandon area studies in, you know, as being this kind of, as you rightly say, a kind of the kind of training which really privileges detailed knowledge of a region through language. I would absolutely defend that. I think where I would slightly disagree is that in therefore saying, well, because what we need are specialists who know about facts on the ground, I think the kind of argument that I'm making is that what I think we need to combine with that detailed, you know, language-based knowledge of an area is also a recognition that the way that those facts on the ground get presented as merely facts, right, is itself in need of a kind of interrogation, and that very often those facts on the ground, are being presented as such, facts about nationhood, about ethnicity, about religious identity, about conflict, and so on, because of certain kinds of implicit ways, I would say, in part of implicit ways of thinking about space and the relationship between, let's say, ethnicity and territory and so forth, or the implicit ways of thinking about the isomorphism of space or the state, which also need to be interrogated. So I would say my call is for a kind of reinvigorating of area studies. And I think that's what I've been trying to think through, and I'm really glad to have this kind of chance to reflect on this collectively, because I think very often when we've tended to make that defense of area studies, it's tended to be because this region is intrinsically, you know, we need specialists on this region, and that's, I would say, that's of course true, but that shouldn't be the only grounds on which we kind of make a defense of area studies. I think it has the potential to precisely unsettle a lot of our categories, you know, a lot of our ways of interrogating how we think about the state, how we think about processes of democratization, how we think about the nature of contemporary authoritarianisms, how we think about secular fundamentalisms. You know, I think there's loads of ways that actually a really nuanced area studies can question a lot of those kind of taken for granteds about how problems get posed in the first place. And it's that that I'm kind of calling for. But.
And I think last question for the first keynote speaker to the second.
Wow, sorry to jump the line, but I'll take it. Madeline, that is just absolutely wonderful. And I actually want to circle back to John's opening question, institutional mm-hmm. question, because I think it's a really interesting one. It's a really difficult one. You know, one series of partners that I've come to see over the last few years that are actually very open to some of the shifts that you're calling for, especially thinking in terms of volumes, in terms of trajectories, traces, and so forth, lie in the professional schools, right? They lie in schools of journalism, in schools of law, in schools of business, in schools of policy too, schools of communication, right? Where by virtue of the fact that they have to define what it is that this professional credential is giving them, what are the trends in the field, they're actually picking up on these dynamic shifts in a way that perhaps our disciplinary homes in the arts and sciences aren't. And, you know, since becoming more of an administrator, I found that our own professional schools are much more open to sort of innovative partnerships and events and things than perhaps our colleagues in the arts and sciences. And so on the one hand, this is really exciting because I think this is a set of new partnerships that we're going to cultivate and grow, and I think are going to produce, you know, some very interesting comparative work. On the other hand, I think it's reproducing the schism that we have in the disciplines themselves. And so I was wondering, you know, what you would think of that. Should we just give up on the disciplines since, you know, frankly, we may or may, you know, probably not going to convince them, right? And to convince the PhDs, hey, you know, we'll give you money. You can go the field, really. Like, heck, you know, you don't even have to give a talk. Like, you know, you can pretend you don't even know us, right? And, like, we'll still, like, support you. To actually having these very willing institutions who think this is, like, really neat and really cool and really dynamic.
Thank you. That's really interesting. And it's also nice to have a kind of an optimistic note on which to end, right? And I think perhaps it's interesting for me why that is. Maybe that, you know, the business schools and the journalism schools and the law schools and so forth, maybe because they're not so invested in the kind of in the institutional apparatuses of being defined as a discipline that has its kind of particular paradigms or methodologies or approaches. And I think it's also so I think, you know, I would agree with you there in terms of that is something that we should embrace. And it's also great that we have lawyers who are, you know, who have a kind of area studies knowledge, or journalists, and there are some fantastic journalists actually working on Central Asia who I think really epitomize that. At the same time, I think it's also really important that we have those conversations within the disciplines. Within the discipline of anthropology, Central Asia is pretty marginal. I mean, it's not seen as a region that generates theory. That's what I'm struck by. And I think within and yet I think we have the potential really to contribute to theoretical debates within a discipline. And I think, you know, within political science, at least in its kind of US variant, which is a very particular kind of beast, I think reminding the folks who work on, you know, American foreign policy that they also do a kind of area studies, right? You know, they also do research that's local, actually kind of reminding people, I don't think that's going to change the logics of hiring in you know, and I think that's a really important and significant contribution. But I think sort of making that claim that, you know, and resisting the tendency to see area studies as doing something that is atheoretical. I think that's something that there is a kind of residual tendency to do that. And I think we sometimes reproduce that in our own languages. And I think contesting that is really important.
Well, with that, I think we are now getting over time. Please join me in thanking Madeline.
Thank you.